which he seemed to be able to do on stage. It was amazing to witness. He's been in the sun, looking like a lobster, pair of shorts on, and we're just sitting around, playing guitars, having a chat, smoke and a drink. Well, I'm on in 5 minutes. We watch the opening number, and out walks this totally transformed thing that seems to have grown at least a foot with presence and command over the crowd. He was in his shorts just now. How did he do that? It's one of those astounding things about working in the theatre. Backstage, you can be a bunch of bums. And ladies and gentlemen, or I present to you, and you're somebody else. Mick and I spent months and months trying to write before we had anything we could record for the Stones. We wrote some terrible songs, whose titles included We Were Falling in Love and So Much in Love, not to mention Walking Through This Sleepy City, which was a rip-off of He's a Rebel. Some of them were actually medium-sized hits. Gene Pitney, for example, singing That Girl Belongs to Yesterday, although he improved on the words and on our original title, which was My Only Girl. I wrote a forgotten gem called All I Want Is My Baby, which was recorded by PJ Proby's valet, Bobby Jameson. I wrote Surprise, Surprise, recorded by Lulu. We ended Cliff Richard's run of hits when he recorded our Blue Turns to Grey. It was one of the rare times one of his records went to the top 30 instead of the top 10. And when the Searchers did Take It or Leave It, it torpedoed them as well. Our songwriting had this other function of hobbling the opposition while we got paid for it. It had the opposite effect on Marion Faithfull. It made her into a star with As Tears Go By. The title changed by Andrew Oldham from the Casablanca song, As Time Goes By, written on a 12-string guitar. We thought, what a terrible piece of tripe. We came out and played it to Andrew and he said, it's a hit. We actually sold this stuff and it actually made money. Mick and I were thinking, this is money for old rope. Mick and I knew by now that really our job was to write songs for the Stones. It took us 8-9 months before we came up with The Last Time, which is the first one that we felt we could give to the rest of the guys without being sent out of the room. If I'd gone to the Rolling Stones with As Tears Go By, it would have been get out and don't come back. Mick and I were trying to hone it down. We kept coming up with these ballads, nothing to do with what we were doing. And then finally we came up with The Last Time, and we looked at each other and said, let's try this one with the boys. The song has the first recognizable Stones riff or guitar figure on it. The chorus is from the Staple Singers version, This May Be the Last Time. We could work this hook. Now we had to find a verse. It had a Stones twist to it, one that maybe could have been written earlier, a song about going on the road and dumping some chick. You don't try very hard to please me. Not the usual serenade to the unattainable object of desire. And that was when it really clicked, with that song, when Mick and I felt confident enough to actually lay it in front of Brian and Charlie and Ian Stewart, especially arbiter of events. With those earlier songs, we would have been chased out of the room. But that song defined us in a way, and it went to number one in the UK. Andrew created an amazing thing in my life. I'd never thought about songwriting. He made me learn the craft, and at the same time I realized, yeah, I am good at it. And slowly, this whole other world opens up. Because now you're not just a player or trying to play like somebody else. It isn't just other people's expression. I can start to express myself. I can write my own music. It's almost like a bolt of lightning. The last time was recorded during a magical period at the RCA Studios in Hollywood. We recorded there intermittently across 2 years between June 1964 and August 1966, which culminated in the album Aftermath. All of his songs were penned by Mick and me, the Glimmer Twins, as we later called ourselves. It was the period where everything, songwriting, recording, performing, stepped into a new league, and the time where Brian started going off the rails. The work was always intensely hard. The gig never finished just because you got off the stage. We had to go back to the hotel and start honing down these songs. We'd come off the road and we had 4 days to cut the tracks for an album, a week maximum. A track would get 30 to 40 minutes to get down. It wasn't that difficult because we're on the road, the band's well oiled. And we got 10, 15 songs, but it was non-stop, high-pressure work, which is probably good for us. When we recorded the last time in January 1965, we'd come back off the road, and everyone's exhausted. We'd gone in to record the single only. After we finished the last time, the only stones left standing were me and Mick. Phil Spector was there. Andrew had asked him to come down and listen to the track, and so was Jack Nietzsche. A janitor had come to clean up. This silence sweeping in the corner of this huge studio, while this remaining group picked up instruments. Spector picked up Bill Wyman's bass. Nietzsche went to the harpsichord. And the B-side, Play With Fire, was cut with half the Rolling Stones and this unique lineup. When we first arrived in Los Angeles on that second tour, it was Sonny Bono who was sent to meet us at the airport with a car because he was the promotion man for Phil Spector then. A year later, Sonny and Cher were being feted at the Dorchester, presented to the world by Armin Ertegun. But back then, when he knew we were looking for a studio, Sonny put us in touch with Jack Nietzsche, and RCA was the first place he suggested. Well, we went more or less straight there, into the limo and pool world, from a 3-day tour of Ireland, in almost surreal contrast in cultures. Jack was in and out of the studio, more to get relief from Phil Spector and the enormous amount of work required to make the wall of sound than anything else. Jack was the genius, not Phil. Rather, Phil took on Jack's eccentric persona and sucked his insides out. But Jack Nietzsche was an almost silent and unpaid for reasons still not clear, except he did it for fun. Arranger, musician, gluer together of the talent, a man of enormous importance for us in that period. He came to our sessions to relax and would throw in some ideas. He'd play when the mood took him. He's on Let's Spend the Night Together when he took over my piano part while I took over bass. This is just one example of his input. I loved the man. Somehow, we still had no money, even by late 1964. Our first album, The Rolling Stones, was top of the charts, sold 100,000 copies, which is more than the Beatles initially sold. So where was the money? In fact, we simply figured that if we broke even, we were cool. But we also knew we weren't tapping a huge market that we had opened. The system was that you didn't get money from English sales until a year after the record came out, 18 months later if it was for foreign sales. There was no money in any of the American tours. Everyone was rooming with everybody. Oldham used to sleep on Phil Spector's couch. We did the TAMI show in America late 1964, the show where we came on after James Brown to get us back home. We earned $25,000. So did Cherry and the Pacemakers and Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas. That's a bit much, isn't it? The first real cash I ever saw came from selling As Tears Go By. I certainly remember the first time I got it. I looked at it, and then I counted it, and then I looked at it again, and then I felt it and touched it. I did nothing with it. I just kept it in my bin, saying, I've got such a lot of money, shit! I didn't particularly want to buy anything or blow it. For the first time in my life, I got money. Maybe I'll buy a new shirt, spring for some guitar strings. But basically it was, I don't believe this shit. There's the Queen's face all over it, and it's signed by the right man, and you've got more than you've ever had in your hand, ever. And more than your dad makes in a year. Schlepping and working his fucking ass off. I mean, what to do with it is another thing, because I've got another gig to do and I'm working. But I must say, the first taste of a few hundred crisp new bills was not unsatisfying. What to do with it took some time. But it was the first feeling of being ahead of the game. And all I did was write a couple of songs, and they gave it to me. One big setback we had was not being paid by Robert Stigwood for a tour we did with one of his acts. If the homework had been done, we would have known that this was his modus operandi. Late paying turned into not paying at all, and we had to go all the way to the High Court. But before that, alas for him, one night at a club called the Scotch of St. James, he made the terrible mistake of coming down the stairs as Andrew and I were going up. We blocked off the staircase so I could extract payment. You can't use a boot on a winding staircase, so he got the knee. One for every grand he owed us, 16 of them. Even then he never apologized. Maybe I didn't kick him hard enough. And when I got some more money, I took care of Mum. They'd split up, Doris and Bert, a year after I left home. Dad's dad, but I bought Mum a house. I was always in touch with Doris. But that implied I couldn't be in touch with Bert because they'd split up. It was like I couldn't take sides. And also I didn't have much time for that because life was getting really exciting. I'm zooming all over the place. I've got other things to do. What Mum and Dad were doing was not at the forefront of my mind. Then came Satisfaction, the track that launched us into global fame. I was between girlfriends at the time, in my flat in Carlton Hills, St. John's Wood, hence maybe the mood of the song. I wrote Satisfaction in my sleep. I had no idea I'd written it. It's only thank God for the little Philips cassette player. The miracle being that I looked at a cassette player that morning and I knew I put a brand new tape in the previous night and I saw it was at the end. Then I pushed rewind and there was Satisfaction. It was just a rough idea. It was just the bare bones of the song and it didn't have that noise, of course. Because I was on acoustic, and 40 minutes of me snoring. The bare bones is all you need. I had that cassette for a while. I wish I kept it. Mick wrote the lyrics by the pool in Clearwater, Florida, 4 days before we went into the studio and recorded it. First at Chess in Chicago, an acoustic version, and later with the Fuzz Tone at RCA in Hollywood. I wasn't exaggerating when I wrote a postcard home from Clearwater that said, "Hi, Mum, working like a dog, same as ever. Love, Keith." It was really down to one little foot pedal, the Gibson Fuzz Tone, a little box they put out at that time. I've only ever used foot pedals twice. The other time was for Some Girls in the late 70s, when I used an XR box with a nice hillbilly Sun Records slap echo on it. But effects are not my thing. I just go for quality of sound. Do I want this sharp and hard in cutting, or do I want warm, smooth, beast of burden stuff? Basically, you go Fender or Gibson. In satisfaction, I was imagining horns, trying to imitate their sound to put on the track later when we recorded. I'd already heard the riff in my head, the way Otis Redding did it later, thinking, this is going to be the horn line. But we didn't have any horns, and I was only going to lay down the dub. The fuzz tone came in handy, so I could give a shape to what the horns were supposed to do. But a fuzz tone had never been heard before anywhere, and that's the sound that caught everybody's imagination. Next thing I know, we're listening to ourselves in Minnesota, somewhere on the radio. Hit of the week. And we didn't even know Andrew put the fucking thing out. At first, I was mortified. As far as I was concerned, that was just the dub. 10 days on the road, and it's number one nationally. The record of the summer of 65. So I'm not arguing. And I learned that lesson. Sometimes, you can overwork things. Not everything's designed for your taste, and your taste alone. Satisfaction was a typical collaboration between Mick and me at the time. I would say, on a general scale, I would come up with a song and the basic idea, and Mick would do all the hard work of filling it in and making it interesting. I would come up with, I can't get no satisfaction. I can't get no satisfaction. I tried and I tried and I tried and I tried, but I can't get no satisfaction. And then we put ourselves together and Mick would come back and say, hey, when I'm riding in my car and same cigarettes as me, and then we'd tinker about with that. In those years, that was basically the setup. Hey, you, get off my cloud. Hey, you, would be my contribution. Paint it black. I wrote the melody, he wrote the lyrics. It's not that you can say in one phrase, he wrote that and he did that, but the musical riff is mostly coming from me. I'm the riff master. The only one I missed, and that Mick Jagger got, was Brown Sugar. And I will tip my hat there. There he got me. I mean, I did tidy it up a bit, but that was his, words and music. A peculiarity of Satisfaction is that it's a hell of a song to play on stage. For years and years, we never played it, or very rarely, until maybe the past 10 or 15 years. Couldn't get the sound right. Didn't feel right. Just sounded weedy. It took the band a long time to figure out how to play Satisfaction on stage. What made us like it was when Otis Redding covered it. With that, and Aretha Franklin's version, which Jerry Wexler produced, we heard what we'd tried to write in the first place. We liked it and started playing it because the very best of soul music was singing our song. In 1965, Oldham bumped into Alan Klein, the pipe-smoking, smooth-talking manager. And I still think it was the best move Oldham made to put us together with him. Andrew loved the idea that Klein had put to him, that no contract is worth the paper it's written on, which we later found out to be painfully true in our relations with Alan Klein himself. My attitude at the time was that Eric Easton, Andrew's partner and our agent, was just too tired. In fact, he was ill. Onward. Whatever happened later with Alan Klein, he was brilliant at generating cash. And he was also spectacular at first in blasting through the record companies and tour managers who'd been overpaying themselves and being inattentive to business. One of the first things Klein did was to renegotiate the contract between the Rolling Stones and Decca Records. And so one day, we walked into the Decca office. A stage-managed piece of theatre by Klein. The most obvious crass ploy. We got our instructions. We're going into Decca today, and we're going to work on these motherfuckers. We're going to make a deal, and we're going to come out with the best record contract ever. Wear some shades and don't say a thing, said Klein. Just troop in and stand at the back of the room and look at these old doddering farts. Don't talk. I'll do the talking. We were just there as intimidation, basically. And it worked. Sir Edward Lewis, the chairman of Decca, was behind the desk, and Sir Edward was actually drooling. I mean, not over us. He was just drooling. And then somebody would come along and pat him with a handkerchief. He was on his last legs, let's face it. We just stood there with shades on. It was really the old guard and the new. They crumbled, and we walked out of there with a deal bigger than the Beatles. And this is where you got to take your hat off to Alan. These five hoodlums then went back with Alan to the Hilton and glugged down the champagne and congratulated ourselves on our performance. And Sir Edward Lewis, he might have been drooling and everything, but he wasn't stupid. He made a lot of money off of that deal himself. It was an incredibly successful deal for both parties, which is what a deal is supposed to be. I mean, I'm still getting paid off of it. It's called the Decca Balloon. With us, Klein was very much Colonel Tom Parker with Elvis. I'll make the deals. Anything you want, just ask me, you got it. Patrician in his dealings with us, and with money. You could always get some from him. If you wanted a gold-plated Cadillac, he'd give it to you. When I rang and asked him for £80,000 to buy a house on Chelsea Embankment near the Mick so we could wander back and forth and write songs, it came the next day. You just didn't know the half of it. It was a paternalistic form of management that obviously doesn't rub anymore these days, but it was still flying then. It was a different state of mind to now, where every fucking guitar pick is paid for and accounted for. It was rock and roll. Klein was magnificent at first in the States. The next tour under his management was cranked up several gears. A private plane to get us about, huge billboards on Sunset Boulevard. Now we're talking. One hit requires another very quickly, or you fast start to lose altitude. At that time, you were expected to churn them out. Satisfaction is suddenly number one all over the world. Mick and I looking at each other saying, this is nice. And bang, bang, bang at the door. Where's the follow-up? We need it in 4 weeks. And we're on the road doing two shows a day. You needed a new single every 2 months. You had to have another one all ready to shoot. And you needed a new sound. If we'd come along with another fuzz riff after Satisfaction, we'd have been dead in the water, repeating with the law of diminishing returns. Many a band has faltered and foundered on that rock. Get Off of My Cloud was a reaction to the record company's demands for more. Leave me alone. And it was an attack from another direction, and it flew as well. So now, we're the Song Factory. We start to think like songwriters. And once you get that habit, it stays with you all your life. It motors along in your subconscious in the way you listen. Our songs were taking on some kind of edge in the lyrics. Or at least they were beginning to sound like the image projected onto us. Cynical, nasty, skeptical, rude. We seemed to be ahead in this respect at the time. It was trouble in America. All these young American kids, they were being drafted to Vietnam. Which is why you have Satisfaction in Apocalypse Now. Because the Nutters took us with them. The lyrics and the mood of the songs fitted with the kids' disenchantment with the grown-up world of America. And for a while, we seemed to be the only provider, the soundtrack for the rumbling of rebellion, touching on those social nerves. I wouldn't say we were the first, but a lot of that mood had an English idiom through our songs, despite their being highly American influenced. We was taking the piss in the old English tradition. This wave of recording and songwriting culminated in the album Aftermath. And many of the songs we wrote around this time had what you might call anti-girl lyrics. Anti-girl titles, too. Stupid Girl, Under My Thumb, Out of Time, That Girl Belongs to Yesterday, Yesterday's Papers. Who wants yesterday's girl? Nobody in the world. Maybe we were winding them up. And maybe some of the songs open up their hearts a little, or their minds, to the idea of, we're women, we're strong. But I think the Beatles and the Stones, particularly, did release chicks from the fact of, I'm just a little chick. It was not intentional or anything. It just became obvious as you were playing to them. When you got 3,000 chicks in front of you that are ripping off their panties and throwing them at you, you realize what an awesome power you have unleashed. Everything they've been brought up not to do, they could do at a rock and roll show. And the songs, well, they also came from a lot of frustration from our point of view. You go on the road for a month, you come back, and she's with somebody else. Look at that stupid girl. It's a two-way street. I know, too, that I was making unfavorable comparisons between the chicks at home who were driving us mad and the girls we fell in with on the tours who seemed so much less demanding. With English chicks, it was, you're putting a make on her or she's putting a make on you. Yay or nay. I always found with black chicks, that wasn't the main issue. It was just comfortable, and if shit happened later, okay. It was just part of life. They were great because they were chicks, but they were much more like guys than English girls were. You didn't mind them being around after the event. I mean, I remember being in the Ambassador Hotel with this black chick called Flo, who was my piece at the time. She'd take care of me. Love? No. Respect? Yeah. I'd always remember, because we'd laugh when we heard the Supremes singing, Flo, she doesn't know, lying on the bed. And it always made us giggle. Yeah, you take a little bit out of this one experience, and then a week later, you're down the road. There was certainly the conscious element in those RCA days, from the end of 65 to summer of 66, of pushing the envelope in milder ways. There was Paint It Black, for example, recorded in March 1966, our sixth British number one. Brian Jones, now transformed into a multi-instrumentalist, having given up playing the guitar, played sitar. It was a different style to everything I'd done before. Maybe it was the Jew in me. It's more to me like having a gila or some gypsy lick. Maybe I picked it up from my granddad. It's definitely on a different curve to everything else. I've moved around the world a bit. I was no longer strictly a Chicago blues man. I had to spread the wings a bit to come up with melodies and ideas. Although I can't say that we ever played Tel Aviv or Romania, but you start to latch on to different things. With songwriting, it's a constant experiment. I've never done it consciously, like saying, oh, I've got to explore such and such a thing. We were learning about making the album the center of attention, the form for the music, instead of just singles. Making an LP usually consisted of having two or three single hits and their B-sides, and then filler. Everything was 2 minutes, 29 seconds for a single. Otherwise, you wouldn't get played on the radio. I talked to Paul McCartney about this recently. We changed it. Every track was a potential single. There was no filler. And if there was, it was an experiment. We'd use the extended time we had with an album just to make more of a statement. If LPs hadn't existed, probably the Beatles and ourselves wouldn't have lasted more than 2.5 years. You had to keep condensing, reducing what it was you wanted to say to please the distributor. Otherwise, radio stations wouldn't play it. Dylan's Visions of Joanna was the breakthrough. Going Home was 11 minutes long. It ain't gonna be a single. Can you extend and expand the product? Can it be done? And that was really the main experiment. We said, you can't edit this shit. It either goes out like it is, or you're done with it. I've no doubt Dylan felt the same about Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands or Visions of Johanna. The record got bigger. And could anybody listen to that much? It's over 3 minutes. Can you keep their attention? Can you keep your audience? But it worked. The Beatles and ourselves probably made the album the vehicle for recording and hastened the demise of the single. It didn't go away immediately. You always needed a hit single. It just extended you without your even really knowing it. And because you've been playing every day, sometimes 2 or 3 shows a day, ideas are flowing. One thing feeds the other. You might be having a swim or screwing the old lady, but somewhere in the back of your mind, you're thinking about this chord sequence or something related to a song. No matter what the hell's going on, you might be getting shot at, and you'll still be, ah, that's the bridge, and there's nothing you can do. You don't realize it's happening. It's totally subconscious, unconscious, or whatever. The radar is on, whether you know it or not. You cannot switch it off. You hear this piece of conversation from across the room. I just can't stand you anymore. That's a song. It just flows in. And also, the other thing about being a songwriter, when you realize you are one, is that to provide ammo, you start to become an observer. You start to distance yourself. You're constantly on the alert. That faculty gets trained in you over the years, observing people, how they react to one another, which in a way makes you weirdly distant. You shouldn't really be doing it. It's a little bit of peeping Tom to be a songwriter. You start looking round and everything is a subject for a song. The banal phrase, which is the one that makes it. And you say, I can't believe nobody hooked up on that one before. Luckily, there are more phrases than songwriters, just about. Linda Keith was the one that first broke my heart. It was my fault. I asked for it and I got it. Her first look was the deepest. Watching her, with all her tricks and movements, fearfully, from across the room and feeling that hit of longing and thinking, she's out of my league. I was sometimes in awe of the women I was with at the start because, I mean, they were the creme de la creme and I'd come from the gutter as far as I was concerned. I didn't believe these beautiful women wanted to say hello, let alone lie down with me. Linda and I met at a party given by Andrew Oldham, a party of some forgotten Jagger Richards written single. It was the party where Mick first met Marion Faithfull. Linda was 17, strikingly beautiful, Very dark hair, the perfect look for the 60s. A blinder. Very self-assured in her jeans and a white shirt. She was in a magazine, she was modelling. David Bailey was photographing her. Not that she was particularly interested. The girl just wanted something to do to get out of the house. When I first met Linda, I was just astounded that she wanted to come along with me. Once again, the girl puts the make on me. She bedded me, I didn't bed her. She made a line straight for me, and I was totally, absolutely in love. We fell for each other. And the other surprise was that I was Linda's first love, the first boy she ever fell for. She'd been actively pursued by all kinds of people who she'd rejected. To this day, I don't understand it. Linda was the best friend of Andrew Oldham's then almost wife, Sheila Klein. These beautiful Jewish girls were a powerful cultural force in West Hampstead, Bohemia, which became my stomping ground in mixed too for a couple of years. It centred around Broadhurst Gardens, West Hampstead, near where Dagger Records was situated, and a few venues around there where we played. Linda's father was Alan Keith, who for 44 years presented a programme on BBC Radio called Your 100 Best Tunes. Linda had been allowed to grow up fairly wild. She loved music. Jazz, blues. A blues purist, in fact, who didn't really approve of the Rolling Stones. She never did. She probably doesn't now. She had been hanging out when she was very young at a place called the Roaring Twenties, a black club, when she was wandering around London in bare feet. The Stones played every night. We were on the road all the time. But still somehow, for a while, Linda and I managed to have a love affair. We lived first in Mapesbury Road, then in Holly Hill, with Mick and his girlfriend Christy Shrimpton, and finally it was just the two of us in Carlton Hill, the flat I had in St. John's Wood. The rooms there never got decorated. Everything piled up around the walls, mattress on the floor, many guitars, an upright piano. We lived, despite all of this, almost like a married couple. We used to take the tube before I bought Linda a Mark II Jag, which had a letterbox 45 player on which she wouldn't play the Stones. We'd hang out in Chelsea at the Casserole, the Marigiana, the Baghdad House. The restaurant we went to in Hampstead is still there, Le Cellier du Midi, and probably still has the same menu after 4 years. It certainly looks identical from the outside. It was bound to unravel with the long absences. Through confusion more than anything, a confusion of suddenly living this life that nobody, or certainly nobody that I knew, had a roadmap for. All of us were pretty young. And we were trying to make this thing up as we went along. I'm going to America for 3 months, so I love you, darling. And meanwhile, we're all changing. For one thing, I met Ronnie Bennett, and I spent more time on the road with her than I did with Linda. We grew apart slowly. It took a couple of years. We would still hook up, but in those years, the band had a total of 10 days off for the entire 3-year period. Linda and I did manage to have one brief holiday in the south of France, though Linda remembers this as a flight she took away from London in escape, a job as a waitress in Saint-Tropez, and me following her and installing her in a hotel, giving her a hot bath. Linda also began taking a lot of drugs. For me to disapprove is an irony, but I did disapprove then. I've seen Linda a couple of times since those days. She's happily married to a very well-known record producer, John Porter. She remembers my disapproval. I was taking little more than weed in those days, but Linda, She was getting into the heavy stuff, and it was having a dangerous effect on her. That was clear to see. She came with me to New York when we were touring the USA in the summer of 1966, our fifth tour there. I put her up at the Americana Hotel, though she spent much of her time with her girlfriend, Roberta Goldstein. When I turned up, they put all the gear away. The downers, the chewinals, which I wouldn't have touched. Imagine! And strewn wine bottles around to give probable cause if they staggered a bit. And then she met Jimi Hendrix, saw him play, and adopted his career as her mission. Tried to get him a recording contract with Andrew Oldham. In her enthusiasm, during a long evening with Jimmy, as she tells it, she gave him a Fender Stratocaster of mine that was in my hotel room. And then, so Linda says, she also picked up a copy of a demo I had of Tim Rose singing a song called Hey Joe, and took that round to Roberta Goldstein's where Jimmy was and played it to him. This is rock and roll history. So he got the song from me, apparently. We went off on tour, and when I came back, London was suddenly hippieville. I was already into that in America, but I wasn't expecting it when I came home to London. The scene had changed totally in a matter of weeks. Linda was on acid, and I'd been jilted. You shouldn't expect somebody that age to hang around for 4 months with all this stuff going on. I knew it was on the break. It was my presumptuousness to think she's going to sit like a little old lady at home at 18 or 19 years old while I gallivanted around the world doing what I wanted. I found out that Linda had taken up with some poet, which I went bananas about. I went running through the whole of London asking people, anybody seen Linda? Crying my eyes out from St. John's Wood to Chelsea, screaming, bitch, get out of my fucking way. Fuck the traffic lights. I only remember some very close accidents, nearly getting run over on the way through London to Chelsea. After I found out, I wanted to be sure. I wanted to see. I checked with my friends, where does this motherfucker live? I even remember his name. Bill Chanel, some poet, so-called. He was a hip little bugger at the time because he came on with the Dylan-esque bit. Couldn't play anything. Ersatz hip, as it's called. I stalked her a couple of times, but I remember thinking, what would I say? I hadn't got that act down yet, how to confront my rival. In the middle of a wimpy bar, or some bistro. I even walked to where she was living with him in Chelsea, almost in the Fulham, and stood outside. This is a love story, and I could see her in there with him, silhouettes on the shade. And that was it, like a thief in the night. That's the first time I felt the deep cut. The thing about being a songwriter is even if you've been fucked over, you can find consolation in writing about it and pour it out. Everything has something to do with something. Nothing is divorced. It becomes an experience, a feeling, or a conglomeration of experiences. Basically, Linda is Ruby Tuesday. But our story wasn't quite over. After she left me, Linda was in a really bad way. Chewinals had given way to harder stuff. She went back to New York and took up further with Jimi Hendrix, who may have broken her heart as she broke mine. Certainly her friends say she was very much in love with him, but I knew she needed medical help. She was getting very close to the danger line, as she herself acknowledged later, and I couldn't deal with it because I'd spur my boat. I went to see her parents, and I gave them all the telephone numbers and places where they'd find her. Hey, your daughter is in distress. She won't admit it, but you've got to do something. I can't. I'm already persona non grata anyway. And this is going to be the final nail in my coffin with Linda. But you've got to do something about her because I'm on the road tomorrow. Linda's father went to New York and found her in a nightclub, brought her back to England, where her passport was removed and she was made a ward of court. She felt that this was a great betrayal on my part, and we didn't speak or see each other again until many years later. She had some close shaves with drugs after that, but she survived and recovered, brought up a family. She now lives in New Orleans. On a rare day off between tours, I did manage to buy Redlands, the house I still own in West Sussex near Chichester Harbour, the house where we were busted, which burned down twice, the house I still love. We just spoke to each other the minute we saw each other. A thatched house, it was quite small, surrounded by a moat. I drove up there by mistake. I had a brochure with a couple of houses marked, and I'm punching around in my Bentley. Oh, I'm going to buy a house. I took a wrong turn, and I turned into Redlands. This guy walks out, very nice guy, and he says, "Yeah." I said, "Oh, sorry, we've come to the wrong turning." He said, "Yeah, you want to go Fishbourne way." And he said, "Are you looking for a house to buy?" He was very pucker, an ex-commodore of the Royal Navy. And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, there's no sign up, but this house is for sale." I looked at him and I said, "How much?" Because I fell in love with Redlands the minute I saw it. "Nobody's going to let this thing go. It's too picturesque, ideal." He said, "20 grand. This is about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and the banks are open till 3. I said, "You going to be here this evening?" He said, "Yes, of course." I said, "If I bring you down 20 grand, can we do the deal?" So I zoomed up to London, just got to the bank in time, got the bread, 20 grand and a brown paper bag. And by evening, I was back down at Redlands in front of the fireplace, and we signed the deal. And he turned over the deeds to me. It was like cash on the barrel head, done in really an old-fashioned way. By the end of 1966, we were all exhausted. We'd been on the road without a break for almost 4 years. The crack-ups were coming. We'd already had a wobbler with the formidable but brittle Andrew Oldham in Chicago in 1965 when we were recording at Chess. Andrew was a lover of speed. But this time he was drunk too and very distressed about his relationship with Sheila, his old lady at the time. He started waving a shooter around in my hotel room. This we didn't need. I hadn't come all the way to Chicago to get shot by some wonky public schoolboy whose gun barrel I was staring down, which looks very ominous at the time, that little black hole. Mick and I got the gun away from him, slapped him around a bit, put him to bed and forgot about it. I don't even know what happened to the shooter, an automatic. Tossed it out the window, probably. We're just getting going. Let's make this, forget it. But Brian was a different story. What was comic about Brian was his illusions of grandeur even before he got famous. He thought it was his band for some weird reason. The first demonstration of Brian's aspirations was the discovery on our first tour that he was getting £5 more a week than the rest of us, because he persuaded Eric Easton that he was our leader. The whole deal with the band was we split everything like pirates. You put the booty on a table and you split it. Pieces of eight. Jesus Christ! Who do you think you are? I'm writing the songs round here and you're getting £5 extra a week. Get out of here. It started with little things like that, which then exacerbated the friction between us as it went on and he became more and more outrageous. In the early negotiations, it was always Brian who would go to the meetings as our leader. We were not permitted by Brian. I remember Mick and me once waiting for the results round the block, sitting in Lyons Corner House. It happened so fast, after we did a couple of TV shows, Brian turned into this sort of freak, devouring celebs and fame and attention. Mick and Charlie and I were looking at it all a bit skeptically. This is shit you've got to do to make records. But Brian, and he was not a stupid guy, fell right into it. He loved the adulation. The rest of us didn't think it was bad, but you don't fall for it all the way. I felt the energy, I knew there was something big happening, but some guys get stroked, and they just can't get over it. Stroke me some more, stroke me some more, and suddenly, I'm a star. I never saw a guy so much affected by fame. The minute we'd had a couple of successful records, zoom, he was Venus and Jupiter rolled into one. Huge inferiority complex that you hadn't noticed. The minute the chick started screaming, he seemed to go through a whole change, just when we didn't need it, when we needed to keep the whole thing tight and together. I've known a few that were really carried away by fame. But I never saw one that changed so dramatically overnight. No, we're just getting lucky, pal. This is not fame. It went to his head, and over the next few years of very difficult road work in the mid-60s, we could not count on Brian at all. He was getting really stoned, out of it. He thought he was an intellectual, a mystic philosopher. He was very impressed by other stars, but only because they were stars, not because of what they were good at. And he became a pain in the neck, a kind of rotting attachment. When you're schlepping 350 days a year on the road, and you got to drag a dead weight, it becomes pretty vicious. We were on a swing through the Midwest, and Brian's asthma got him, and he was in hospital in Chicago. And hey, when a guy's sick, you double for him. But then, we saw pictures of him, zooming around Chicago, hanging at a party with so-and-so, fawning over stars with that silly little bow around his neck. We'd done 3-4 gigs without him. That's double duty for me, pal. There's only 5 of us, and the whole point of the band is that it's a 2-guitar band. And suddenly, there's only 1 guitar. So I've got to figure out whole new ways to play all these songs. I've got to perform Brian's part as well. I learned a lot about how to do 2 parts at once, or how to distill the essence of what his part was and still play what I had to play, and throw in a few licks, but it was damn hard work. And I never got a thank you from him, ever, for covering his ass. He didn't give a shit. I was out of it. That's all I would get. All right, are you going to give me your pay? Well, that's when I had it in for Brian. One can get very sarcastic on the road and quite vicious. Just shut up, you little creep. Preferred it when you weren't here. He had this way of ranting on, saying things that were just great. When I played with so-and-so, he was totally starstruck. I saw Bob Dylan yesterday. He doesn't like you. but he had no idea how obnoxious he was being. So it would start off, "Oh, shut up, Brian." Or we'd imitate the way he cringed his head into his non-existent neck. And then it went to baiting him in a way. He had this huge Humber Super Snipe car, but he was a pretty short guy, and he had to have a cushion to see over the steering wheel. Mick and I would steal the cushion for a laugh, you know, wicked schoolboy sort of stuff. Sitting at the back of the bus, we just let him have it, pretending he wasn't there. "Where's Brian? Shit, did you see what he was wearing yesterday?" It was the pressure of work. And the other side of it was that you hoped that kind of shock treatment would snap him out of it. There's no time to take time off and say, "Let's sort this out." But it was a love-hate relationship with Brian. He could be really funny. I used to enjoy hanging with him, figuring out how Jimmy Reed or Muddy Waters did this or T-Bone Walker did that. What probably really stuck in Brian's craw was, was when Mick and I started writing the songs. He lost his status and then lost interest. Having to come to the studio and learn to play a song Mick and I had written would bring him down. It was like Brian's open wound. Brian's only solution became clinging to either Mick or me, which created a triangle of sorts. He had it in for Andrew Alden, Mick and me. He thought there was a conspiracy to roll them out, which wasn't true at all. But somebody's got to write the songs. You're quite welcome. I'll sit around and write a song with you. What have you come up with? But no sparks flew when I was sitting around with Brian. And then it was, "I don't like guitar anymore. I want to play marimbas." "Another time, pal. We've got a tour to do." So we got to rely on him not being there. And if he turned up, it was a miracle. When he was there and came to life, he was incredibly nimble. He could pick up any instruments that were lying around and come up with something. Sitar and paint it black. The marimbas on Under My Thumb. But for the next 5 days, we won't see the motherfucker and we've still got a record to make. We've got sessions lined up, and where's Brian? Nobody can find him, and when they do, he's in a terrible condition. He barely ever played guitar in the last few years with us. Our whole thing was two guitars, and everything else wove around that. And when the other guitar ain't there half the time, or has lost interest in it, you start getting overdubbing. A lot of those records is me 4 times. I learned a lot more about recording doing that. And also, how to cover unexpected situations. And just by the process of overdubbing and talking to the engineers, I learned a lot more about microphones, about amplifiers, about changing sounds of guitars. Because if you've got one guitar player playing all the parts, if you're not careful, it sounds like it. What you really want is to make them each sound different. On albums like December's Children and Aftermath, I did the parts that Brian normally would have done. Sometimes I'd overlay 8 guitars and then maybe just use 1 bar of the take here and there in the mixing. So at the end of it, it sounds like it's 2 or 3 guitars, and you're not even counting anymore. But it's actually 8 in there, and they're just in and out in the mix. Then Brian met Anita Pallenberg. He met her backstage around September 1965 at the show in Munich. She followed us to Berlin, where there was a spectacular riot. And then slowly, over several months, she started going out with Brian. She was working hard as a model and travelling about, but eventually she came to London and she and Brian began their relationship, with soon enough its bouts of high-volume violence. Brian graduated from his Humber Snipe to a Rolls-Royce, but he couldn't see out of that either. Acid came into his picture around the same time. Brian disappeared late 1965, when we were in mid-tour with the usual complaints of ill health, and he surfaced in New York, jamming with Bob Dylan, hanging with Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground, and doing acid. Acid to Brian was something different than to your average drug taker. The dope at the time really wasn't, at least as far as the rest of us were concerned, a big deal. We were only smoking weed and taking a few uppers to keep us going. Acid made Brian feel he was one of an elite, like the acid test. It was that cliquishness. He wanted to be a part of something, could never find anything to be part of. I don't remember anybody else going about saying, "I've taken acid." But Brian saw it as a sort of Congressional Medal of Honor. And then he'd come on like, "You wouldn't know, man. I've been tripping." And he's primping himself. That terrible primping, the hair. The little idiosyncrasies became so annoying. It was the typical drug thing. They think they're somebody special. It's the head club. You meet people who'd say, "Are you a head?" as if it confers some special status. People who were stoned on something you hadn't taken. Their elitism was total bullshit. Ken Kesey's got a lot to answer for. I remember well the episode Andrew Oldham describes in his memoir and gives such symbolic weight to. When Brian lay collapsed on the floor of the RCA studio in March 1966, straddling his guitar, which was buzzing and interfering with the sound. Someone had to unplug it, and in Andrew's telling, it was as if Brian were being cast adrift forever. To me, it was just an annoying noise, and the concept was not something we were particularly shocked about, because Brian had been toppling over here and there for days. He really loved to take too many downers, seconals, chewinals, desputules, the whole range. You think you're playing Segovia and think it's going diddle diddle diddle, but actually it's going dum dum dum. You can't work with a broken band. If there's something wrong in the engine, an attempt has to be made to fix it. In something like the Stones, especially at that time, you can't just say, "Fuck it, you're fired." And at the same time, things couldn't go on with this really rancorous fission. And then Anita introduced Brian to the other lot, the Camels and that particular set, of which there will be more bad news.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.